cache of food and blankets, camping gear underground, because when it rains, this entrance gets sealed with water. Media got a hold of it, and they went bananas. So the knee-jerk reaction was for the media to scream at the government, you need to do something about these people entering our caves and stealing our secrets, whatever that might be. They found out that some of these cavers belonged to the British Naval Reserve. So they branded them as British military in our caves, stealing our secrets. And the consequence of that was that all caves got banned to us. It was the locals who rallied and threatened the president that these are our friends, these are our godson. These people bring money into our territory and bring them back. Right. So we were actually invited to come back. That was one of those warm, fuzzy feelings that you get.
Geocaching. How did you guys discover that?
When the good geocaching times happen, there's also good caving things going on. We're still leaning towards caving as opposed to geocaching. But when we have a moment, we always know how to find it on the web, and so we'll go there. I had a GPS. I was looking around to find anything that I could about GPSs. This geocache word popped into my karma, and I think I even bookmarked it. It wasn't too awful long that we bumped into a geocache quite by accident. So we decided, well, we'd look back on the website again, and we did that, and we found one close to our house and couldn't find it. So it was wintertime, and we stomped back out there again to find it again, and we still couldn't find it. And the clue was so obvious, and I remember it well, that moss will never grow on the
north side of this tree.
Well, I was looking for a half a standing tree, and finally, in desperation, we called Glenn and said, okay, we give up. We can't find it. Glenn Nash. He said, oh, no, we were just out there and checked it. It's still there. So we went back again and found it that time. That sort of set the pace for us. We ran around like a couple of seven-year-olds in the neighborhood looking at all the geocaches. And when we met you guys, it was just done for us. We were hooked because you guys are as much like a caving community as what we have come to know and love. And there's a lot of commonality between the two because there's a lot of people that go out into the woods. And there's ticks and chiggers out there. And it's hot and sweaty and full of snow. And nobody's afraid to do that. You know, they don't just say, well, I'm going to stay home and watch television. You know, there's a lot of the kinds of physical discomforts involved in geocaching as there is with caving.
Treasure hunting.
It is.
Adventure.
Yeah. So, you still have the same GPS receiver you had when you started?
A Magellan 2000. I had it up until just a few months ago, and I left it down in Arkansas and called them up and said, well, you can have it. It was so old and so inaccurate that it still worked for caves. I could still find caves with it. Its resolution was rectangle 100 feet north and south and 80 feet east and west. All I know is that it would refine down to degrees, minutes, and seconds. And one second in Missouri is 80 feet east and west and 100 feet north and south. And those numbers didn't change. I could get a north-south line or east-west line, and I would have to walk at least that far before that last digit changed. I couldn't go out and buy a new one while that one still worked. I finally went out and I bought another new one.
Conveniently left it in another state.
Yeah.
So what do you have now?
It's the cheapest E-Trex. It was
the yellow?
It's a yellow one, and it's the H. It has the high-sensitivity receiver.
That's good.
This one was $85 Bass Pro. We got that just before heading into Mexico. We were doing some cave radio stuff last fall at Carroll Cave. It was in the middle of a sleet storm at midnight. I had one of those receivers in my hand, and I was amazed. I could walk 2 feet, and it would tell me that I walked two feet. In all that freezing cold, dark, stormy night, it took me exactly where I wanted to go. We had calculated a point close to where we expected the transmitter in the cave was going to be. That was how we arrived at that spot, and I was hooked. I had to have one of those. I'm probably going to have to buy another one because I'm just dying to get a hold of some of you guys and find out more about the mapping capabilities of using a better one with some memory in it.
You guys have been caching for years. You have 38?
Yeah, not many.
Have you found caches that you just don't log or you're very selective?
No, we haven't logged a couple of them.
Yeah, there's some that we just stumbled on. We were out at Tyson or Rockwoods. We were just hiking through the woods and went, wow, you know, this would be a perfect spot for a cache. And if I was hiding a cache, I'd put it right there, and it was there. We found them without even knowing that they were in existence.
I feel a cache.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the ones that you've found? Are there some that are memorable?
Oh, yeah. Every one of them. Route 66 State Park.
I like the one over there by the little train.
Yeah, Glencoe. That was RGS. That was his.
Angus 1 and Angus 2.
Yeah.
We went back there two more times. We took friends and let them practice with their GPS and just walked with them. And we took our grandkids just for the hike. Actually, we went four times because Amy went with us one time.
Geocaching has introduced us to places that we would never have found otherwise. I thought that I knew every bit of my backyard, and I was so wrong.
I might have met you guys at the third cache you found, which was Bell Mountain.
Yes, it was.
We were,
yeah.
That was the first. I remember that one pretty well.
Oh, that was a wonderful trip. I just fell in love with everybody.
I missed those. Those were the heydays of geocaching. Let's meet at 5 o'clock on Highway 21, and let's caravan down, and let's walk a mile and
yeah.
find a cache and walk a mile and then eat in the parking lot.
Yep.
I remember you talked about one in Louisiana that you found interesting. I don't remember if it was a virtual
It was a virtual. Chalmette was a battleground, the last battle in the War of 1812, which we fought with the British. It was a virtual cache. And so we went there, and the clues were what was on the door at the tower. There was a limestone obelisk 100 feet tall. And so we found that, and then we climbed to the top, and we looked out over the battleground. Oh, another one of the things was how many cannon are on the esplanade.
I think there were nine.
There were some little pop guns, little bronze cannons down there, you know, look like 4-inch diameter barrels, you know, and not didn't look like a battleground at all. So we climbed to the top of this tower, and on the way down, one of us started humming part of a tune, and by the time we got down a couple of flights of steps, it was 1814. We took a little trip, you know, along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. So by the time we got to the visitor center, I walked in the door and challenged this guy with a Smokey the Bear hat. I said, how come I'm not hearing that song? You know, it should be brought. He went purple. He was livid. That song is not the truth. It's not what happened. Oh, he was just incensed with that. And I beg your pardon, brother. I thought it was pretty funny. And I'm glad that I knew where I was, because so far there wasn't anything to tell me where I was and why this spot was important to the United States. The song told me exactly what happened there, right. But the ranger didn't. Came back the next day, and there was another person there who was just wonderful, and she told me exactly what happened and why it was so important and why that piece of ground was hollow and sacred. And it was amazing, the history that's in that little square piece of land. Almost every time we go back down there, we go back out to Chalmette.
So the fact that the geocache brought you there...
It did.
...helped you discover a little bit of history.
Oh, a big chunk of history, yeah. It was just enormous, because I never learned anything in school about that and how critical that little piece of land was. That was the only land bridge that would allow the British to come in and attack New Orleans. Hmm. The important part that Jean Lafitte played in that, he was a pirate. The British tried to strike a devil's deal with him. They said, we will pay you a lot of money if you will help us through your swamps so we can attack New Orleans. And he said, no, I don't think so. He said, I think I'll stick with the Americans. You can give me gold, but I got a lot of that. He says, they can give me immunity from my sins. So he struck a deal with the Americans and refused to help the British.
I think we should place a cache at Lafitte's blacksmith shop.
Oh, that's a good idea. Lafitte's bar in the French Quarter of New Orleans. Best hurricanes in the whole wide world, bar none.
That's the only reason we stop by New Orleans anymore, is go to Lafitte's for a hurricane and drink coffee over at the...
Café du Monde.
Café du Monde. Watch people.
Geocaching has taken us a lot of places we would never have gone, and they've been just stunning. There was this perplexity at not being able to find some, and then the feeling that you get when you finally do figure out the clues and you hit yourself in the head with a rock for being so stupid.
What is disappointing is we go places in Mexico and later find out that, oh, there was a cache there.
Buxley's map has been our friend. He has all this area, the Illinois side of the river. I was surprised to find Mexico. He's got a page on all the caches down there. We lurk a lot. We'll go check and see what everybody else has been doing. Maybe we'll do that four or five times a year. And we miss the campfires and afternoon excursions. I guess the best story that I've got is that cache at Lone Hill Onyx Cave down in Merrimack State Park. We went caving on a crisp and clear January day.
Biology count day.
One of the fellows had a GPS that for some reason he didn't want to trust to the environment of the cave, so he hid it in a little solution pocket on the outside of the cave as we went in. So we had our good time, and we spent several hours in the cave, and we came back out, and we were going to go get something to eat. We were all hungry and tired, so he reached up into the solution pocket, and his GPS was gone. Well, he was pretty frantic because it wasn't his GPS. It belonged to his boss, who was not a real likable kind of guy anyway. So we looked and looked and looked and ascertained that it just simply was not there and somebody had taken it. We drugged this fellow up to a Mexican restaurant in Sullivan. We went in to get a couple of pitchers of margaritas, and he got on the phone to his boss. And he took a thrashing over the phone for a very long time. So finally, we just took a picture of margaritas out there and started pouring margaritas into them. You don't have to take this abuse. It's a stinking GPS, and it's
with cable locations.
So
yeah.
It did have some sensitive information on this GPS, but basically pretty useless to anybody who might have found it. We loosened him up a little bit, and he was able to survive enough to get home. And the next day, just on a whim, I thought, well, I'm going to go see if there's any geocaches around there, and there certainly was. A geocacher came by and found that this fellow recognized it. The title screen had the name and the address of the owner, so he did the right thing. He figured that it didn't belong there, and it wasn't going to do it any good to leave it there, but he could take it home and return it to the rightful owner since he found the owner's name, address, and telephone number. He called the owner up, and the owner screamed at him to the point of there wasn't any conversation going on at all. Ultimately, the guy that found it just mailed it on his own nickel back to the rightful owner. Well, this was just too good for me to pass up. I had to share this with the caving community and with the geocaching community, that these two groups of people had come so close together over this GPS, and nobody knew that the other even existed. It's been a wonderful story in our repertoire of tales that right was done. The owner got his GPS back, and we have $1 million worth of stories to talk about this guy.
And I've got pictures of the GPS receiver that I took before I mailed it back. And I got a card back thanking me for sending it back to him.
Well,
oh, good.
We have to apologize for that guy. He's our cross to bear. That's one of our best GPS stories. And one of our best caving stories, too.
It was Elaine and Barry and I looking for that cache, and we never found it. But we found a little treasure along the way.
Wasn't that wonderful? Well, I'm certainly glad it happened, because it certainly brought us together. And the GPS community has been certainly a wonderful group to party with as any I've ever been in. I'm looking forward to generating a lot more stories. I've had a lot of fun every time we've gotten even close to you guys. The ingenuity of this sport has just blown me away, and I just love it. Can't wait to wallow in some more of it.
Thanks again, guys.
You're
welcome. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All my life told me you're pretty good for a girl. Someday you'll play the off-key just like Sonny Bob and Earl. I'm living green. Never dreamed, Mom and Daddy, they taught me right to be an all-American bluegrass girl singing here tonight.
Well, that's the final full-length interview of the Slaga Geocaching Podcast. Episode number 100 will be a retrospective of all of the previous podcasts in this series. It will be published on July 30th, 2008, the 3-year anniversary of this podcast.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.